Welcome to the Writer's Market Podcast, which is focused on helping writers find more success with their writing. I'm your co-host, Robert Lee Brewer.
And I'm your co-host, Brian A. Clems.
Together, we're Robert and Brian, and this is our show.
The Writer's Market Podcast is hosted by writersmarket.com and the Writer's Digest Writing Community, a division of F&W, a content and e-commerce company.
Let's see what's on tap today. Okay, so we're going to talk to Carol Topp, CPA, today. And CPA, of course, means a certified public accountant, which means that there's a lot of, she does a lot of tax and business type related stuff. So I have a question, Brian. Do you do your own taxes?
I do my own taxes. I have for a number of years. I was fortunate enough that my dad worked for the banks. And he was very good with numbers and taught me early on how to do my own taxes. It became a little trickier when I was doing a lot. I started doing freelance work out of college and my early jobs, and even to this day. And he helped me walk through the Schedule C and what to do. And so I do have for a writer, someone who loves words and dictionaries and thesauruses and usually shuns the math books, I do have a pretty good concept of what to do for taxes, particularly for freelance writing and my freelance writing business. So how about you? Do you do your own taxes or do you hire someone?
I do my own taxes, and it really goes back to seventh grade at a general business class where we would fill out taxes and stuff. So then I always felt empowered to be able to do it by hand. And now I use TurboTax to do a lot of it. Which makes the process so much easier, especially, as you said, as we get into freelance stuff where you have a lot more loose ends, I guess, that you have to tie up. So
right. It's so funny because you mentioned using TurboTax. For as new wave and as spirited as I am for adapting to new technology and being an early adapter, I still like doing my taxes longhand. I've done it both ways to make sure that it balances out, to make sure I get the same number a couple of years. But I mean, I print out those old sheets. I used to pick them up at the library, and now they're harder and harder to get. So I have to print them up myself and fill them out and do my math with my calculator. My girls look at my calculator and they say, "What is that?" You know, I've got this old school calculator I sit next to me, and it's pretty amusing. So
yeah, well, that's why I'm old school with a lot of stuff still, but yeah, taxes, TurboTax makes my life so much easier.
Probably
so.
Takes you about a tenth of the time it takes me.
do you do your taxes early, or I know I like to do mine pretty much as soon as I've got everything together, just to kind of get it done and out of the way. What's your take on it?
Ideally, I like to do them early. In fact, I think there's been a couple years where I've knocked them out pretty early in February. I've been fortunate. In recent years, though, it's certainly I generally start the process in early February, making sure I have all the documents I need. I start running through, you know, my emails. I have email folders that keep track of things. I use Google spreadsheets to track everything as well, and I go through that and start formulating my own numbers and making sure I have receipts or whatever it is lining up. But I found that I also do my mom's taxes, and between those two, it does take me a while. And I wouldn't say I'm last minute, because I'm certainly there before tax day, but usually it's more like the end of March by the time I get everything settled and mailed off to you know, the IRS. And thankfully, most years I've gotten a little bit back. I haven't had to owe too often. I've planned ahead. And that's another key. Are you pretty good about – you do them all early. Are you pretty good about planning ahead tax-wise?
Yeah. And this is – I think this is with the TurboTax stuff makes it so much easier, where, you know, I don't have to worry about getting out to the post office or anything. Everything's e-filed, and I usually just pick a weekend and get it all thrown out there together. So there is, and usually I do get a return because of how I set it up. But what was it? 2 years ago, I owed like $5 of taxes to North Carolina, which was very random, related to my book releasing solving the world's problems releasing, and I had this $5 tax I had to send out, and I think I ended up waiting until April 15th to get that that tax
don't want North Carolina to pay
that $5 to make sure I didn't get in trouble.
So, don't want North Carolina.
So that's kind of like
to
my
that.
Weird tax story. But,
$5 one day, North Carolina comes for you. Robert Lee Brewer owes us $5 plus interest. Well, I'm glad you made it out in time.
I don't know. Do you have any weird tax stories at all? Or it's pretty.
You know, most of mine have been pretty easy going. The most difficult year I had with taxes was actually right after I started with Writer's Digest. I came on board. I was so excited to be here. But before that, and we're based in Ohio. I don't know how many people know that. But before that, I had a magazine job in Chicago, Illinois, and worked pretty hard. So for that particular year, or the following year, when I had to do my taxes, it was incredibly tricky because I remember having to fill out state taxes in Illinois and state taxes in Ohio. And my wife had a job while we lived in Ohio. She actually had a job in Kentucky. So we had state taxes in Kentucky as well. And if I can't remember, you had a North Carolina. I know I had another state where I had done some freelance work. And for whatever reason, there was trickiness with that. So for one year, I had these stack forms that were, you know, not a mile high, but slightly under a mile high of all these different state rules and state taxes and the way to fill things out. And I remember that was the most difficult year I ever went through. And thankfully, by the end of it, I did not owe any taxes anywhere. We had already paid them all. And I think we got, like four different checks back. But, I remember being a little stressed out and thinking this would have been a good year to hire a CPA. So if I ever roll along that again, I'm like you. I kind of take pride in the fact that I can do this mathematical thing that's different from my day job and my freelance job and the other things I do. But, that year was probably a mistake doing it on my own. I learned a lot, but it took me. And I do them all longhand, so it took me so much time to do all of them. So that's kind of the trickiest tax returns I ever did. Ever since then, it's been relatively smooth sailing. Once, and I'm sure we'll talk to Carol about this, but once, I started doing things and understanding the Schedule C and how that works and operating at a business with my freelance career, it made things a lot easier.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I'm really looking forward to talking to Carol here. So we're about to talk to Carol Topp, but first we have three things and the platform tip of the day. Welcome to Three Things, the part of the Robert and Brian Show that takes a look at three specific things writers need to do to find more success with their writing. This time around, I'm going to focus on the three things writers need to do to write effective query letters. They are the hook, details about the project, and an author bio. First up, the hook. This element of the query letter should always be the first thing, and in most cases, it should be accomplished in just one juicy sentence. The best hooks, whether fiction or nonfiction, often present a problem, ask a thought-provoking question, or give an enticing snapshot of what project you're about to pitch. The second thing needed in a query letter is details about the project. This element of the query letter should be accomplished in 1 to 3 concise paragraphs. You don't have to cover everything in a query, just the highlights. The main goal of this part of the query letter in nonfiction is to establish there is a need and that you've got a plan to answer that need. For fiction, you'll want to share the most compelling elements of the story to entice the editor or agent to want to read more. Third, writers should include some form of author bio. The bio should be a very concise 2 to 3 sentences at the most. If you've had a book published or won any relevant awards, include that. If you're an expert in the field on which you plan to write, include that. If you have absolutely no experience, do not include that. Instead, just include something to the effect of, I am a writer living in Suwanee, Georgia, or wherever it is you live. Believe me, if the first two elements haven't won editors and agents over, the bio is not going to be the thing that puts you over the top. Remember, the query letter is not the finished product. So you don't need to include everything in the kitchen sink. Rather, touch on the most important pieces of whatever it is that you propose to write, and give just enough to make editors and agents want to see more. If you can master these three things, you'll find you've mastered the art of selling your writing. Until next time, keep writing and marketing what you write.
And now, your platform tip of the day. Today's topic, Twitter. Why should you be on Twitter? Too often I hear people say, why be on Twitter? I don't want to read about what people are eating for lunch. But that's not what Twitter is. Well, some people do occasionally share what they're eating for lunch, but I don't find those intrusive or boring. I just find that they make me hungry. But before we establish why you should be on Twitter, let's first answer the question, what is Twitter? Twitter is a social media tool used for sharing, learning, and connecting with people. Think of it like a scrolling news feed at the bottom of your local news channel. Only you get to decide what's in that feed based on who you follow. And if you find it interesting, you can chat with whoever shared it. Or better yet, think of it like an iPhone. iPhones aren't just used to make phone calls. Thanks to apps, they are used to do many different things. Some people use iPhones to text friends. Others use it to read news or check their banking accounts. Some, like my wife, use it to play Candy Crush. I use it to do all these things and much, much more. Twitter is the same way. It's like an iPhone. It's used by different people to accomplish different things. I use it to get news, see what people are talking about, crowdsource information, and connect with others. And that last one is the most important when building your author platform. As an author, Twitter is made just for you. If you're an extrovert, you have a forum to chat with folks all the time. If you're an introvert, you have the ability to connect with folks without having to mingle awkwardly in public. Plus, you can do it from home, in your PJs. And if you're like me, that is a big selling point. Now, on Twitter, your tweets or messages that you send are limited to 140 characters. And what I mean here is your tweets can contain no more than 140 letters, numbers, and spaces combined. It challenges you as a writer to keep your writing tight. And as editors will tell you, that's a good thing. So why is Twitter an effective platform for writers? It allows you to meet people from all over the country and all over the world. This is important because your goal when creating your writer platform is to find people who may be interested in what you write. So how do you get started? If you're not already on Twitter, sign up now. Use your real name or your author name if you use a pseudonym because you're trying to establish your brand as an author. Who should you follow? You can start with Robert and me just by searching Robert Lee Brewer and Brian Clems, and that's Clems with a K. We'd love to connect with you, and hopefully you'd find what we share interesting and learn a lot about what you can share. You should also follow Writer's Digest and any other person, group, or entity that you think will enrich your life and your career. Robert also put together some excellent lists of writers to follow on his blog, robertleebrewer.blogspot.com. Just search best tweets for writers to follow. Now, what should you share? Here's the key. Pick three things of interest to you and start with posting tweets about those as often as you can. For example, most people know me as the online editor of Writer's Digest, as the author of Oh Boy, You're Having a Girl, and as an avid baseball fan. So 90% of my tweets tend to be about writing, raising daughters, and baseball. People generally know what they can expect from me. Writing tips, funny advice on parenting, me complaining about the Cincinnati Reds bullpen meltdowns. And thankfully, many people find most of my posts valuable enough to follow. And that's the key. You want to provide value for people. So when picking your three things, think about your audience. And by audience, I mean the people who would be most likely to buy your books. That way, you can share your blog posts with them. By the way, if you don't have a blog, you should start one. And when your book comes out, you've built a list of people who want to hear from you. And it's to that list you can promote your books. For more tips on building your Twitter platform, go to writersdigest.com/buildyourplatform. Also, for the best resource on platform building, get a copy of Create Your Writer Platform, The Key to Building an Audience, Selling More Books, and Finding Success as an Author, which you can find at writersdigestshop.com.
All right, we have Carol Topp with us today. Carol Topp is a CPA, is an author and accountant who converts tax rules and business language into clear, easy-to-understand English. She has authored 11 books, including Business Tips and Taxes for Writers, the Micro Business for Teens series, and the IRS and Your Homeschool Organization. In addition, she is a contributing author in Writer's Digest's 2015 Writer's Market and The Writer's Guide to Self-Publishing. Carol has also published several magazine articles, speaks at writer's conferences across the country, and hosts a podcast, The Dollars and Cents Show. Her website is taxesforwriters.com. And if you'd like to catch Carol at an upcoming event, she will be the guest presenter at a webinar on how to start a publishing business sponsored by the Association for Publishers of Special Sales with host Brian Jude on March 24th, 2016 at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Visit bookapss.org for more information on that event. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Hey, good morning, Robert. How are you?
Doing good. I guess my first question is one of those almost like dumb questions, might seem obvious to many, but what is a CPA and what do CPAs do?
It's not a dumb question at all. I do workshops for teenagers, encourage them to start their own business, and many of them are wannabe authors, and I ask them that, and usually they go real quiet. Maybe someone who's had an uncle or a dad or you know, relative who's a CPA can come up with accountant, but they don't know what the rest means. So I explain that certified means I took a very hard test. Imagine 4 years of college shoved into 2 days of testing, and I passed. That's what certified means. Public means I serve the public. I don't work just for one industry. I serve many clients, and I have a lot of nonprofit clients, a lot of small business clients. It's starting to be tax season here, so I have tax clients, and I have this carve-out niche of helping authors, writers, and self-publishers as well as my clients.
Okay. So when you're helping people, are you helping them just manage their money? Are you helping them with their taxes?
Primarily taxes, but I do a lot of telephone consultations, especially because, you know, there's one thing, you know how it is to read or try to understand the tax code is not very easy. And it's not like the IRS has a page that says, hey, you know, writers, authors, go here. So I created a website called taxesforwriters.com. And just to try to make what is the IRS tax code for small businesses applicable to writers and authors. So I do the phone consultations. I talk to them about how their business should be set up. That's what that webinar you mentioned in March I'll be doing for apps. We're going to talk about business structure. Today we're just going to talk about, I think, just general tax tips and stuff. But, yeah, largely taxes, but a little bit of just advice, like do you want to be an LLC or not? What does that get you? Stuff like that.
Well, that's a great question. What does an LLC get you?
It doesn't get you any tax savings, I will tell you that. If you came to me and you said, hey, my business is an LLC, what tax form do I file? Or if you called the IRS and said, I'm an LLC, what tax form do I file? The IRS would say, well, we don't recognize LLCs. That means it's not a tax status. It's a legal status. It gives you legal protection. It limits the liability, and I tell my clients, when you hear the word liability, think lawsuit, or okay, really the money, the damages from a lawsuit. It limits the damages of the money from that lawsuit to your business. Meaning if a lawyer or any small business, my business, Carol Topp CPA, has LLC status. If you guys sued me, you could only get what's in my business checking account. You can't get my retirement fund. You can't get my house. You can't get all my personal assets. Limited liability.
Now, at what point do you recommend that anybody who's pursuing a freelance career or a writing career create an LLC, or is there a tipping point where they should?
You know, not really. It's really a matter of that author, writer, considering their level of risk. You know, so again, if you're small, maybe you just wanted to publish your memoir to hand it out to your family, you know, low risk of ever getting sued. But on the other hand, I knew of a man who was a contract ghost writer, and he just could not make this author that hired him happy. And the author sued him, you know, because I don't know why. He just sued him. I guess maybe it whatever. And fortunately, the ghostwriter had limited liability company status and said, well, fine, not fine, but if you sue me, at least you're only going to get the money in my business, which is, and we can talk about this in a minute, why I encourage people to separate their business and their personal life. If you mix the two, the court might say, hey, you mixed all this money in the same checking account, your business money and your personal. Guess what anybody who's suing you can take? Everything that you've mixed.
Yeah, and I imagine if you're married, that might make even your spouse's income like come under fire, right?
Yeah, potentially it could, right? Which is why I think it was in one of the two Writer's Digest books, Robert, I can't remember which article, I specifically talk about business. I think it's in the Guide to Self-Publishing, you know, establishing your business. And if you are going to set up an LLC, I give some tips like set up a different checking account. Don't mingle the two sources of money, because there you've just shot a big hole in your limited liability.
Yeah, great. Everybody should check out those articles in the Writer's Market books.
Yep.
I have another quick question on that front, and this may be backing up even a little thinking before LLC kind of status. I know a lot of people have asked this before. Can you kind of comment on the difference between if you're writing, differentiating it as a hobby versus as a business, especially when it comes to, I mean, mainly when it comes to tax purposes?
Yeah, that is very tricky. And the IRS has some guidelines, and I devote a chapter to this topic of, you know, hobby writing in my book. It's called Business Tips and Taxes for Writers. Because what the IRS is trying to assess is your intent. Did you have a profit motive? That's kind of hard for them to tell. So they have a bunch of criteria you need to look at. I can't remember. I think there's about 7 of them. But I tell most authors, basically, if you're going to the point of, you know, attending writers' conferences and subscribing to Writer's Digest, you know, reading the books, being serious about it, chances are you have a profit motive. The author is the person who assesses that best. But it doesn't hurt to hop on over at my website, Taxes for Writers, type the word hobby in and see what kind of articles and those 7 criteria that I mentioned, and see which one of those fit you. And they're just things like, you know, have you had success at this before? Do you have a publishing contract? That already means that you are a professional writer. You are not a hobbyist. And I say, really, hobby status. A lot of people think, oh, I'll just call myself a hobby writer and then I won't have any tax problems. And it's exactly the opposite. It's worse, you know, because hobby writers have to report any and all income they might make. So even if it's very low, if you get paid to edit somebody's work or if you sell a few books, you got to report all that. But a hobby writer cannot deduct practically any of the expenses. I mean, in theory they can, but it's subject to itemized deductions and a certain limit, so in real practice they don't. So basically anybody who's going to call me or read a book called Business Tips and Taxes for Writers is probably not a hobby writer, right?
Right. I hope not. I hope they're taking it
seriously. That's right. Exactly.
So are there a few basic deductions that writers kind of overlook that you've noticed over the years?
Yeah, one is mileage. They seem to forget that when they drive, you know, again, to attend a writer's conference, drive to the bookstore to do research, drive to the library to do research, you know, drive to meet with a CPA or a professional or something like that, keep track of your miles, write down the date, where you went, the purpose of the trip, and the mileage. And I use Google Maps a lot to figure out mileage because I don't like watching my odometer, but at least I keep track of where I went, how many miles I drove, because those are deductible. Other things, sometimes if you are truly studying a genre or doing research and you buy books, and this is really tricky for the fiction writers because they can buy a lot of books and read a lot of books. But if you're really doing it with the intent of writing or understanding that genre, some of those books could be a reasonable amount, could be research expenses. You know, again, the author is the one who can best tell, did I buy this book strictly for my own entertainment, or am I buying it because I'm really researching a new genre here or the way this author writes? It will make me a better author. Then it is a legitimate business deduction.
Gotcha. Are there any red flags? Are there any big mistakes that writers often, that especially when you do phone consultations and that kind of thing, where they say, oh, I've been trying to claim this or do this, that could be a red flag to the IRS or a mistake that they're really making?
Yeah, I can think of two biggies. One is travel expenses, especially travel to exotic places. And the other one is their book purchases. So let me start with purchases first and then remind me to talk about travel.
Sure.
But, you know, if they buy a whole boatload of books, they think, oh, well, I spent, you know, X thousand dollars buying these boatload of books. They're sitting on a pallet in my garage. I want to deduct all that. And I say, sorry, there's this concept called cost of goods sold. Meaning you can only deduct the cost of the book as you sell it every year. So if you only sell 20 of those, you know, thousands of dollars worth of books or 1,000 books, you can only deduct that year on your taxes the cost of those 20. You're supposed to basically use up your inventory and deduct it as you sell the books. That means you got to keep track of your inventory. And, you know, most authors are not numbers people, and they don't like doing that. So they think, well, it's just easier. I'll just deduct it all in the year. But according to the law, we cannot do that. The other one is travel. So I have a tax client. He writes kind of in the Sherlock Holmes genre, kind of a spinoff.
Okay.
And his publisher's in London. So he called me and said, Carol, I'm going to London, you know, going to meet my publisher. And my wife is coming with me. And I said, great. But her ticket is not tax deductible, your airplane ticket is. And then he spent some days playing tourist and researching. So I said, just keep track of, you know, what days, therefore the hotel, are business oriented, and what days where you spend it playing tourist, therefore your hotel expenses are not deductible. And he did a good job of outlining it, talking to me beforehand. And, you know, we submitted the tax return with rather high travel expenses, but we knew we could back any and all of them up with a business purpose. The reason for him going over there, obviously, to see his publisher and do research.
It sounds like, you know, just kind of having an idea of, you know, record keeping is definitely part of this. So, it sounds like maybe, you know, people that want to get the most out of their expenses, they have to kind of know ahead of time what they're doing. Is there anything else that like a writer can do to get like the most out of their expenses?
They can
plan ahead of time for it.
Definitely.
At the beginning of the year?
Yeah. And this is a good time for them to read some stuff. Cause we're still early in a new year, but, over at my website, Taxes for Writers, four is spelled out. F-O-R, taxesforwriters.com. I've got two things people might be interested in. One, if you sign up for my email list, you get this ebook I create. I think it's only like 10 or 12 pages, but it is tax deductions that are common for authors to take. So there I just boiled it down to things that are common for authors to take. So I'm not going to talk about weirdo tax deductions like, you know, oil and gas depreciation, okay? I'm not going to talk about that, right? So you don't have to sift through all the IRS stuff. I kind of did it for you. That's over, like I said, if you sign up for my email list. And the other thing I have there, I think it's right on the homepage at Taxes for Writers, is a spreadsheet I created. And I created it for a friend. Again, she's an author, but she is not a numbers person. And I said, Jules, here's a way you can keep track of what you sell and by month and what your expenses are. And then the spreadsheet rolls it up into one summary. So again, that tax client I tell you who went to London, he gives me that spreadsheet every year. He tells me, you know, how easy it is for him to use. And I love it as his tax preparer too. Because I'm like, good, you summarized it all, you know, what you spent on, whatever. There's a column there for miles as well. There's a column there for when you make purchases of your books. And then he's a good guy. He gives me, here, I counted my inventory near the end of the year. I have so many copies of this book and that book and this book. And we keep track of, therefore, what inventory he sold. So those are two things to help with record keeping, that spreadsheet and that list of tax deductions for writers.
Well, that's actually great, because a couple of the questions that I get regularly from writers that I was going to ask actually were, is there a cheat sheet available of some basic things that writers should be on the lookout to deduct, and as well as, is there software you recommend to writers to help track income and expenses? And so it sounds like you go to taxesforwriters.com and sign up for the newsletter, and you'll get both. So my next question kind of falls along these lines of, you know, if someone's really nervous, if they're a writer and they're extremely nervous because they're terrible, just terrible at numbers, which, you know, a lot of us go into writing just to strictly get around that. Do you recommend hiring a CPA right away and, like, for you getting, you know, consulting and getting some basic information? Or are there a couple of small steps other than downloading this income and expenses track sheet that they can take to ease themselves into this business side of writing?
Yeah, I'd have to say, you know, go to the website, read a few articles. Yeah, there's a lot you can do before you might sit down with a CPA. Okay. And obviously, you know, spend the $12 or $15 to buy my book, because you will be so much better educated. And also, in the book, I kind of give some tips on that first interview with the CPA, how to even find one, how to talk to one to find out if they're a good fit for you. And I say things like, if you walk out of that first meeting, and just about any good CPA will give you 15 to 30 minutes of their time. Okay, not during tax season, so wait till after tax season.
That's true, avoid tax.
Please,
avoid
tax
season.
Right, but, you know, have a consultation with them in the middle of the summer and say, I'm thinking I need a CPA, I read this book, you know, and follow some tips in there, you know, and you ask them, basically, do you have any authors or writers as your clients? That's a really good question to start with. You know, go to your writers group and ask them who they use. Ask other small business owners, who do you use as a CPA? You kind of want a small business CPA. Not necessarily someone who, I don't know, specializes in corporate income tax. That's not most of our writers, right? Not someone who does mergers and acquisitions or anything like that. Start with reading the book. You get better educated, and then you're so much more equipped to go to a face-to-face consultation and ask them the important things like, okay, what do you do for me? What will it cost? Give me an estimate. If they can't give you an estimate, go to the next CPA, because they should be able to do that for you. Should be able to say, well, what do you really need me to do that much record keeping? How much record keeping is it possibly going to be? Bring your checkbook. Bring your business checkbook. I hope we talk about that. That's separate from your personal checkbook, and show them, well, here's my, you know, income and expenses. And they might be able to work just from your checkbook. I might say, this is fine. I can go from there.
Can you give us, and maybe you can't, I don't know, but can you give writers kind of a ballpark of what they should expect, maybe from a basic consultation by way of cost? Or, you know, is it really broad, and, you know, what should surprise them? You know, what shouldn't?
Yeah, that's kind of tricky. Okay, I'd have to say, if you go and get your taxes prepared somewhere, and please not the storefront, you're now a professional, you're running a business, so they are not equipped to do your storefront. The storefront tax preparers, you just sit there and bring in your W-2, are not prepared to help you. So if you go to CPA, I'd say I think roughly the average cost of a tax return with what I'm going to call the Schedule C, that's your sole proprietor. That's most of the writers out there. We're sole proprietors, meaning we're not partnerships or corporations. We're sole proprietors. I'd say you're looking at $250 to $400. That's your personal income tax return and adding in this Schedule C, your business.
Okay.
That's real rough. Might go higher. You know what? The nicer their office, the more expensive it's going to be.
Right? Well, right? You know, that's absolutely good to know. So when you walk in and you see the
exactly.
the fancy paintings and all that, it may cost you more. But I'm glad you're setting expectations for it. I think writers really don't know what to expect by way of cost, and to be clear, they can they write that off as a business expense?
The business portion. So when I give my bill to my business, small business clients, all of them are sole proprietors, sometimes their businesses are just part-time, you know, I say, okay, here's the personal part of your income tax return, here's what I had to add on to do your Schedule C, your business income and expenses, and then that's the number we carry forward next year and deduct as a business expense. So you got to separate personal and business life. And that's sometimes hard because, you know, as writers, we mix the two together a lot. But on paper and for tax purposes, you got to separate the two in your thinking, if that makes sense.
It's great advice.
I know that you know, you've mentioned at least one of your books here, but I know you've written many of them. How do you handle your writing along with your work as a CPA?
It gets ignored. Is that true for everybody? Oh my gosh, I have a contract. They haven't actually sent me a written contract yet, but I had agreed I'm going to write a book about how to encourage entrepreneurship in your children. Since I wrote similar books, I thought, no problem, no big deal. Well, I think it's due like in April or May, and all I've done is outline the chapter titles. I'm like, oh, shoot, girl. It's not easy. It's good to be held accountable. So I think I'm going to have to go put it on my calendar, block out days, because, you know, the tyranny of the urgent and the you know, the emails keep coming and they seem to be more urgent than this agreement I made to write a book. So I have not been writing much lately at all. I put out one book last year, but it's, I got to tell you, it's not easy. I belong to a writer's group, so maybe they'll help keep me accountable if I go to the monthly meetings.
Well, I hope your deadline isn't during tax season.
No, I hope not either. I better double check that contract, otherwise I'm, yeah. I don't think I was that foolish.
So how hard is it for you to write a book? I mean, this is all information you know.
Yes.
It's stuff you're very fluent in. It's stuff you can be extremely helpful to other writers, you know, other than the deadlines and squeezing it in time-wise, what's the most difficult thing that you deal with in your own personal writing?
I only write nonfiction. I had an idea for a work of fiction once, and I ran it past my two daughters, and they were like, Mom, you're not really going to do that, are you? No, okay, all right. I think fiction is so hard. I'd have to say probably the research right now. Like this book I'm going to write about encouraging your children to be entrepreneurs. I thought, well, I'll make a chapter on good books, biographies of entrepreneurs, to suggest. And now I'm thinking, oh, shoot, there aren't that many. I mean, I can't recommend that a 10 or 12-year-old read Steve Jobs' biography. He's not a nice guy, right? Yeah. Oh, dear. So I'm going to have a heck of a time doing the research to try to come up with this list. And then I feel like, okay, now I want to vet these books. I want to read these books before I recommend them to anybody. And then you get bogged down in the research, right? And you're not putting words on paper or on your screen as it is. So that's the hard part for me.
Yeah, so you mentioned that you have a writing group that meets once a month. How does – I guess maybe this is a two-part question. Like, first, how did you find this group? And then secondly, like, what do you get out of the group that you found?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember how I found it. I think via somebody on Facebook – another writer friend on Facebook or something, because it's local. It's a local group. It meets at a library. We had been meeting at a little restaurant type place till it closed. But what this writer's group, and they're all a little different, but this writer's group has a nice balance of encouragement, and somebody prepares a small lesson. So I did a small lesson on adding humor to your writing. Other people have create lessons on, using the correct tense or voice or building drama. A lot of these are, a lot of the people in the group are, fiction writers. So even though it doesn't always apply to me, I still go because I figure it makes me a better writer, period. You know, better at describing things, even though I don't, like I said, I don't really put my hand at fiction. And then we take about, that's about 45 minutes for that lesson, then another 45 minutes to critique. So people are encouraged to bring in, partial chapters of whatever they're working on, or maybe a blog post. I've taken parts of the article that I wrote for Writer's Digest. I took that to them because I figure here is my audience live. If they understand what I'm trying to say, then it's good to submit to Writer's Digest. So
they got the sneak peek, huh?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did.
See, they're wiser already.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, do the people in the group you said that they all kind of have different writing backgrounds and they write different things. Do you find it a bit of a challenge for you, since you write mostly strictly nonfiction, to edit potential fiction essays or novel stuff?
Not so much, because I love reading novels. Right. It's when the poets come out and they write poetry. And I'm like,
think okay, that's a shot at you, Robert.
Yeah. Sorry, Robert, but oh my goodness. The first time a poet brought her work, I thought you critiqued poetry like you critiqued nonfiction. And so I'm saying things to her like, well, I see your parallel construct here, you know, A to B, B to C, C to D. But here she wasn't consistent, you know, with her. And she said, well, I just write what comes into my mind. And I thought, that sounds like, as a nonfiction writer, that sounds like cheating. I can't just write what comes into my mind. I got to do research and fact check.
Well, Robert's the pro, so I'll let him chime in on if that's legal or not.
She was not a published poet. I don't think she ever got paid for her poetry or got it even published or anything. So take that in mind.
Yeah, well, you know, there's personal writing, whether it's poetry, fiction, or nonfiction. I think there are writers in every genre that just write whatever comes into their mind. but then if you want to get published, yeah, you do have to have a little bit of accountability
Thank you.
Now, kind of shifting gears a little bit, you've spoken at writing conferences. Typically when you go, I assume you, of course, talk about taxes and how that applies to writers. Do you have any interesting stories of people you've met there that have asked really bizarre questions or anything like that?
There was one. I was one in Florida recently, and they just had wonderful questions. There were probably 50 people in the room, and I would just kind of, try to get through my talk, but they had so many very good questions that we would keep getting interrupted. And then there's usually one in the crowd who felt like he knew more than the speaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that happens sometimes.
And so I would try to be polite, but I would try to steer the question back to, you know, first of all, did you have a question? Are you just challenging me because you want to appear like a know-it-all? I did my best to try to keep the train on the tracks, if you will. And I'm not afraid to just walk back over to my laptop and hit the button to go to the next slide. You know, so let's get back on track. You know, I'd say stuff like that. It's a tricky thing, you know, that crowd control and that kind of management of the person. And you know, the organizers came up to me afterwards and apologized, and they knew him, and they were afraid it was going to happen. Oh, and then when he's like not trying to pull me down, he's there talking in a rather loud whisper to another presenter. And they weren't even in the back of the room. They were to the side. And it was so distracting to me as the presenter, and therefore I know it's distracting to my audience, that I had to ask them to please take their conversation into another room.
Well, that's really good advice. It's a note to writers that, you know, when you attend writers' conferences, know that the presenters are there to help. And if you have a question, that's great. And if you have a question that may challenge what the speaker is saying, it's best to do it in a polite fashion and honestly seek curiosity opposed to being kind of
a show off. I think the difference is, do you have a question at the end, or are you just trying to start an argument or sprout something?
Right.
You know, is there a question? And sometimes is there a question there? You know.
Yeah. Do you enjoy speaking at writers' conferences?
I do. I do very much, because I get to frequently attend the conference and learn a lot and therefore become a better writer. So.
Mm-hmm. How did you first get started on the speaking at the different events? Did you like pitch them, or did people start coming to you first, or?
I pitched them at first. I still do a little bit when I really want to go somewhere, but I think I started locally with some local writers groups or somebody, like I've done some for the Society of Children Book Writers and Illustrators, and they have chapters everywhere. I would email a lot of people and just get invited. And that's how you do a lot of things, right? You practice first, you get better. And then I finally got to the point where I wasn't doing it for free. You know, I was asking for an honorarium and travel expenses and things like that. So that's kind of a nice position to get to, but you got to work your way up to that. It took a couple of years and practice, and practicing knowing what the audience, what their needs are by the questions that they ask, listening to them. So, yeah, I enjoy it.
And then I know you've got your podcast show, the Dollars and Cents Show. I'm guessing from the title what it's kind of about, but like.
Yeah.
What different topics and like kind of what format maybe too? Like, is that podcast set up?
It's switched. I've been doing it for 2 years, and at first it was me just talking about whatever I wanted to talk about, like a like a body of knowledge. But I have part of the problem is I'm a little disjoint in my podcast. I talk to, like I said, I have a book series on microbusiness for teens. So I talk about that. How can you teenagers start a microbusiness? Oh, well, let's branch out and talk to, you know, adults who want to start a small business. Oh, let's talk to parents who want to teach their children about managing money. And then, so I'm talking about all that stuff. And then lately, what I've been doing so much public speaking that I thought, well, let's just turn those into podcasts. So I did a wonderful workshop at a homeschool convention with an author. She was, I think, 17 at the time, but when she was 15, she was published by Zondervan. Got a two book contract. They wanted to write a third, but she's in college now and too busy. So her name's Rachel Coker. She was very personable, wonderful, and the teenagers who want to be writers just loved having her talk a lot more than me. So I put that into a podcast. So over at dollarsandcentsshow.com, you'll find it. I think it's called How You or Your Child Can Become a Published Author. And I cut it into usually 2 half-hour podcasts because it's hard to listen to too much longer. I listen to lots of podcasts, but I think the shorter keeps the audience's attention a little bit better. I went on a little bit of hiatus, and I don't know when I'll get back to it again. I might not get back to my podcast till maybe March or April after tax season ends because I'm a bit behind. And, you know, they're wonderful. I love podcasts, but they are a lot of work, you know, the editing, just setting up interviews and finding interesting people to interview and things like that, so.
Yeah, we can relate, although you've been extremely interesting to interview, and we're lucky that you are one of our first, so we're very happy to have you. You talked briefly about how you talk to about small businesses and writing for adults and also for teens. Is there a big difference between explaining the basic tips between each of them, each of those groups, or is it the same, or do you deliver it differently? How does that work?
Yeah, I definitely deliver a different message if I'm speaking to teenagers than their parents. And a lot of times I speak to the parents sitting in the room. And the kids who are interested either in writing or in starting some other kind of business have a lot of questions about, you know, what should I write about? What should I sell? Okay, they're more focused on the product or the delivery or something like that. And it's usually a parent in the crowd that puts up their hand and says, what do we need to do about insurance? Or what do we need to do about taxes? You know, they're focused on the more nuts and bolts. So definitely with the kids, I have a tendency to be a little more inspirational. You can do this, rah, rah, I'll get you started. And then the parents swoop in and ask questions about taxes.
You know, Robert, do you have any more pressing questions?
I think we're probably ready for your 10-question blitz. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking. For our listeners who don't know, at the end of every interview, I like to do a 10-question blitz. And these are 10, you know, semi-rapid-fire questions where I don't want you to think too heavily. I just kind of want you to answer, and it should be fun. Carol, are you ready?
I hope so.
All right, we are ready for the 10-question
blitz.
It's
like Jeopardy? Yeah.
Kind of. You don't have to answer in the form of a question, though.
Good.
So, anyway.
Number one.
What came first, the numbers or the writing?
The writing.
The writing. So how long have you been a writer?
I wasn't thinking of me. I was thinking historically.
Oh.
like, you know.
Good answer.
Number two.
I read that you didn't grow up wanting to be an accountant or writer. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
I wanted to be an architect.
Why?
I loved, my dad would bring home magazines of floor plans. I loved looking at them.
Cool.
Yeah.
Number three.
What should a writer look for in a CPA?
Someone that they understand. And I have in the book like a trick question, not a trick, but if they can explain Section 179 deductions well, you found a good CPA.
Section 179. I'm repeating that.
It has to do with depreciation of assets with a life more than a year.
Oh, good. That's actually great advice and a great tip.
Number four.
You've spoken at a lot of conferences. What's the one thing you say that really catches people's attention or should catch their attention?
Yeah. It's you're in business before you make money. You're in business when you have expenses.
Oh, that's a great tip, too.
Number five.
What was the most difficult part of writing Business Tips and Taxes for Writers?
Probably keeping up with the tax code. I got a one-star review because they somehow found that the tax code had changed between when I wrote the book and when they read it, and they gave me a one-star review.
Oh, that's that kind of stuff's so frustrating. I've got a book, and I'll get a one-star review, and it's because Amazon didn't ship it in time. And it's like, well, I can't do anything about that. So that kind of thing's frustrating. Like, we understand your pain there.
Number six.
You're from Cincinnati, my hometown. And Robert's hometown. Yep. Are you more of a Reds fan or a Bengals fan?
Reds fan. I can't afford to go to Bengals games, but I've been to Reds games several times.
Great. Go Reds. And go Bengals on the side.
I'm really a Packer fan. Oh, I grew up in Wisconsin. So.
Oh, no. Although I do love Aaron Rodgers. I think he's
great.
Yeah,
cool. Who doesn't?
He's fun to listen to. He's so good. Yeah. So,
number seven.
Are you a morning writer, day writer, or night writer?
Morning.
Number eight.
Since you can handle math and write well, you're kind of a superhero to us. What superhero name should we all call you in the future?
You know, my last name is Top. I married a guy named Top. And somebody said, who is in marketing, you really got to do something with that name. And I haven't come up with anything very good. I was thinking, you know, Top Talker, Topinator. My daughter, who's a photographer, she said should be Toparazzi.
Toparazzi? Oh, I think that's great. I think that maybe even Captain Toparazzi. that's great.
Number nine.
What's the most common question you get asked by writers?
Oh, God, what is the common question? I think it might be similar to that. Should I be an LLC, that one? Or what can I deduct? You can ask that question. Can I deduct and then fill in the blank kind of questions? Those kinds of things.
Makes sense.
Yeah, nothing too bizarre, but... Mm-hmm.
Number 10.
As an accountant with a successful writing career, what's the one piece of advice you can offer to writers scared of numbers?
Get a CPA to look over your previous year's tax return. Get somebody to do it at least every 3 years, because you can go back 3 years and amend your tax return if you've made a mistake or missed a deduction and overpaid your taxes. So get somebody to look at it at least once every 3 years. Not during tax season. Go to them over the summer and say, would you look over this? How am I doing? If you've prepared your own taxes.
This is great. This has all been very, very wonderful advice, Carol. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
You're welcome. Happy to do it.
Thanks. And good luck during the rest of tax season.
Thanks.
It takes me forever to work on my taxes. And so I can appreciate how much effort you must put in around these months.
Yeah, I'm attending a webinar tomorrow about the new tax changes of the PATH. Let's see, what's it called? Something funky. Protecting Against Tax Hikes. Something crazy like that is the new tax update legislation that got passed at the end of the last year. So, yep, got to attend classes about it.
All right, well, thanks again, and we appreciate you being on the show.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so to learn more about Carol Top CPA, go to taxesforwriters.com and caroltopcpa.com. I found that interview very fun. How about you, Brian?
She was wonderful. I learned so much. Even as we talked earlier, I've been doing my taxes for a number of years, and while some of those things sounded vaguely familiar, she was able to give some insight into why things are the way they are and particular things that you can miss as a writer. And so I thought she was really informative, and I took away a lot. What are some of the key points that you took away from the interview?
Yeah, there were two things. The first one was for writers to consider registering as a LLC, a limited liability company, just because, you know, she made the great point about separating your liability as far as
your home. And I think a lot of times as freelance writers, we just think of ourselves as ourselves. But if you don't do that LLC and somebody comes after you, they could also, and you don't have the LLC, they could come after you for your house or your car or, you know, your regular bank account. And, you know, and your spouse's bank account, I would imagine, too. So that was very interesting. And then also the second thing was she mentioned having a CPA look over your taxes at least once every 3 years. And that kind of perked me up a little bit. And then when she explained that it's because you can make amendments within a 3-year time period, that made a lot of sense. So, and I always think it's best for, kind of getting off track a little bit, for writers to get writer's market every year. But I know that there are some college professors that advise like every 2 to 3 years. And it's like that same thing. You know, if you're not going to get it every year, get it done every year, at least get it done, you know, once every 3 years. So, what did you take away, Brian?
The main action items that I took away from talking with Carol were these. Number one, if you have a business motive and you can show it, you can consider your writing as a business for tax purposes. And I know that goes back, and a lot of writers asked it. In fact, even I've asked it, you know, how do I consider my writing a business versus it being a hobby? And these are two distinct things, as Carol points out. And she said that if you're spending money going to writing conferences, buying writing reference guidebooks like the ones we offer in the writersdigestshop.com, meeting with agents, etc., and can show you're working to make a profit, then yes, your writing is a business and you can classify it that way on your taxes. But, and it's a big but, if you don't show a profit in the first couple of years, that will be a big problem and will be a red flag to auditors. Now, you know, so if you aren't showing a profit, then it's considered a hobby and there's less that you can write off. There are more restrictions on that. And I know if you go to her website, taxesforwriters.com, she has a bunch of information about there. In fact, I was peeking at it while we were doing the interview. So I know she has a lot of great info there. Check it out. The second action item I took away was don't forget to track mileage. And this is something early on I used to forget to do when I went to writing conferences. You know, when you're traveling to a conference or to a bookstore or to somewhere to do research for your article or novel, Carol said that that's a business expense that can be deducted on your taxes. You know, be organized, put it all in a spreadsheet. I believe she mentioned one of her clients who is overseas in Europe who does this, and by tracking it so that at the end of the year, you have everything ready to go. And finally, the third real takeaway I took is similar to yours about the hiring the CPA every 3 years. She did say if you're not good with numbers, hire a real tax professional to help you at tax time. You know, don't go to the corner shop that gets advertised on TV that does your taxes quick. She said specifically to find a true tax professional who knows about small businesses and can be your partner on this for years to come. And I think that's a real important note, especially for a lot of writers who don't consider themselves good at math, or maybe they were good at math in high school but purposely went into writing. So numbers, the only numbers that they saw were the paychecks that they got for their freelance or for their royalty checks, that kind of thing. So I think that was an important note, that don't be scared of going to a tax professional. In fact, embrace it. And that's something that all writers should consider. So those were really the action items I took away. I'm sure I could have come up with a lot more, and even you came up with a couple more than I did. So I hope as writers, you can know going into tax time and feel more comfortable with what you're doing, how you're tracking it, and how you'll benefit from that on your taxes. Anyway, I want to thank Carol Topp for coming on the program. Taxes really can be a beast, but she made it sound manageable for freelancers. From Robert Lee Brewer and me, Brian A. Clems, thanks for listening to the Writer's Market Podcast. Come visit us at writersmarket.com and writersdigest.com. And don't forget to stop back next time for more great publishing advice. Until then, take care of yourself and your writing.